Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Induction a posteriori would have brought phrenology to admit an innate and primitive principle of human action, a paradoxical something which we may call perverseness, for want of a more characteristic term. In the sense I intend, it is in fact a mobile without a motive not motivert. Through its promptings we act without comprehensible object, or, if this shall be understood as a contradiction in terms, we may so far modify the proposition as to say that through its promptings we act for the reason that we should not.
In theory, no reason can be more unreasonable, but in fact there is none more strong. With certain minds, under certain conditions, it becomes absolutely irresistible. I am not more certain that I breathe than that the assurance of the wrong or error of any action is often the one unconquerable force which impels us, and alone impels us, to its prosecution. Nor will this overwhelming tendency to do wrong for the wrong's sake admit of analysis or resolution into ulterior elements. It is a radical, a primitive impulse, elementary.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And if you recognize that opening reading, you must be into the deep cuts of Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, this story didn't even have him burying anybody alive.
Yeah, this is not, like you say, this is not going to be a hit single from Poe by any means. This is more of a deep cut. You're probably far more familiar with The Telltale Heart or The Black Cat. Two stories that contain similar elements and then we'll touch on later in this episode.
Yeah, so this is from Edgar Allan Poe's 1845 short story, The Imp of the Perverse. And we start with this today because in this short story, Poe brings up this concept of the imp of the perverse, or this motive toward perversity, the idea of doing something exclusively for the reason that you know it should not be done and not for any other reason. And in this story, The Imp of the Perverse, there is actually a murder. You don't get to the murder for a while. Poe makes you wait. Before any plot, there's just this long musing complete with lots of references to the pseudoscience of phrenology. But it's a musing on this particular impulse of perverseness, the powerful urge to do what we should not and to do it simply for the reason that it should not be done. And so Poe goes on to analyze this concept throughout this sort of essay section of the story. He calls it a radical primitive impulse, and he contrasts it with other types of drives that we have, which he frames in terms of the pseudoscience of phrenology again. He says it's different from mere combativeness because combativeness stems from an instinct for self-defense, right? It's rooted in the desire to be well and to protect yourself from injury. So Poe writes, quote, "But in the case of that something which I term perverseness, the desire to be well is not only not aroused, but a strongly antagonistical sentiment exists." So I take that to mean he's trying to make clear he's not talking about any kind of self-defensive combativeness or antagonism, but rather a kind of suicidal antagonism, a thwarting of one's own best interests simply because you have a desire to do something that you shouldn't do.
Now, the example that Poe uses here, of course, is one that I think most of us can't directly relate to. The idea of this impulse to confess a secret murder that you committed. But the idea of being tempted to do something that you absolutely know you shouldn't do, like for no logical reason,
right,
other
that's
than
not in your own interest, yeah.
Right. Like, I think we can all relate to that on some level. Like, I often think about this kind of thing when I'm in meetings. If
yes.
I'm, say, you know, like a one-on-one meeting with my boss, like say it's a you know, a performance review or, you know, what have you, I'll suddenly, you know, I'll be sitting there nodding, listening, absorbing the information, and then like this random thought will occur, like, what if I licked the desk right now?
Yes.
You know? What if I started eating an ink pen, uh-huh. not just chewing on it, but just like really, you know, chowing down on it? And I'm not logically tempted to do these things, but then once the idea is in my mind, I just keep thinking about it.
I mean, it's different from – like there are two very different ways to have a desire to say something inappropriate during a meeting with one's boss or mm-hmm. something. One reason would be, well, maybe you've got all these kinds of pent-up feelings about your boss and you're very angry and you mm-hmm. think you've been wronged or something like that. And then that would be a sort of natural – desire to express your feelings and rebel against some kind of injustice or get revenge by saying what
right.
you really think. That would be one thing. You're talking about something different, and Poe's talking about something different. When all those feelings aren't even necessarily there, just having this impulse to say something or do something completely inappropriate for no good reason at all.
Right.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I often have this thought when I'm in like a meeting or, you know, something's going on. Sometimes something just flashes into my head like, I could utter the following sentence and it would destroy my career.
Yeah. Or just you think like, well, what if I like crab walked out of this meeting mm-hmm. right now? You know, it wouldn't be that difficult to do, and yet it would totally change everyone's perceptions of how I how I experience reality and the seriousness with which I take my job, that sort of thing. And I guess as we'll come back to in this episode, a lot of it comes down to just that weird dividing line between thought and action.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost as if whenever you do this, you're exploring what it means to contemplate an action without doing it. It's kind of the same way. It's almost like you're feeling the texture of something in those moments where you wonder what it would be like to swerve into oncoming traffic or to jump off of a tall ledge. I mean, I remember a while back you did an episode with Christian about the idea of the call of the void. And I think this touches on some similar stuff, right? It's not necessarily mm-hmm. that people do have suicidal ideation that is more deeply rooted in ongoing problems they have. But there's also just these sort of like momentary fleeting impulses that don't even seem to be connected to anything larger.
Yeah, yeah, that was I definitely recommend listeners go back to that episode because we touched on not only how that we get these ideas in our head, this weird temptation when we're say atop a tall building or on a cliffside, But in that episode, I shared how in the past, I've also felt like this weird feeling like I need to press my wallet to the bottom of my pocket for fear that I'll take my wallet out and say, throw it over the railing of the Empire State Building. And, you know, which is something I definitely don't want to do. But then once the idea has entered my head, it does sort of feel like I should take steps to keep it from happening.
Yeah. And you almost feel like you wonder for a second, am I going to be able to stop myself?
Yeah.
In this long section where Poe talks about the idea of peering into an abyss in the story, he says, quote, "There is no passion in nature so demoniacally impatient as that of him who, shuddering upon the edge of a precipice, thus meditates a plunge. To indulge for a moment in any attempt at thought is not to be inevitably lost, for reflection but urges us to forbear, and therefore it is, I say, that we cannot. If there be no friendly arm to check us, or if we fail in a sudden effort to prostrate ourselves backwards from the abyss, we plunge and are destroyed." So it's this weird thing where he's almost like saying, you got to depend on some kind of part of you to suddenly be the guard. What if that part of you, the guard, isn't paying attention in some moment?
I believe I mentioned this in the Call of the Void episode, but stuff like this always makes me think of the author Robert Graves, his partial autobiography, Goodbye to All That. Mm-hmm. Where he talks about his experiences in the war, but also of mountain climbing. And if memory serves, there's this one part where he talks about climbing, scaling these cliff sides with some friends, and how like the scariest moment was when birds were sailing close by, and having to sort of wrestle with this weird illogical feeling of what have I let go? What if like the birds were sort of tempting them with this siren song of like, you know, let go and fly with us.
I don't know if this is inspired by that, but I seem to recall a kind of stock scene in a lot of cartoons, like Wile E. Coyote type cartoons, where a character, often the kind of bumbling, prone to injury kind of character, would be out over a ledge on a precipice or on a tightrope or something and would be harassed by a bird fluttering around nearby. There's something that does seem to go deep about you being vulnerable at the edge and then a creature that has powers that you can't, just floating around as light as a breeze.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely experienced it, say, standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon. Well, not the edge. several feet back, but still watching a bird traverse these to this drastic change in elevation without any issue at all.
Now, personally, Robert, do you find yourself to be, I think the term would be crimnophobic, having a fear of sharp drop-offs and precipices?
Yeah, at times, yeah. Like we have another episode that we are currently researching and recording soon on mountains. Mm-hmm. And just looking at certain pictures of mountains, looking at specifically walkways carved into the sides of mountains.
Oh, yeah.
At times they made me cringe a little bit because I could just imagine myself crawling up or down those stairs as opposed to, you know, walking up and down them like a normal pilgrim or something.
This is funny because I have tons of fears. I'm full of anxieties about all kinds of things in the world, but not this. I'm almost kind of drawn to sharp drop-offs. I always want to go right up to them and look over.
Yeah, well, not me. But of course, it's always a challenge taking a small child to these places.
Oh, yeah.
Because my son, he definitely wants to go up and check out the edge, and it just that unnerves me even more.
Well, I can imagine that would change everything. My whole life, I've had the experience of being told to stay away from the edge, even now.
Yeah, well, I had this issue before a kid was in my life for sure, though. It's just the edge is too close.
Well, anyway, sorry. So to come back to the Edgar Allan Poe story, the story goes on to tell of how the narrator, he gives this long essay, this kind of speech about phrenology and about the imp of the perverse. And then he tells a very brief version of his story, which is that he came up with an ingenious plan to get away with murder. And the way he did it was he murdered someone with a poisoned candlestick because he knew they would light a candle to read in bed at night. And so he gets away with the murder undetected. But then years later, having totally gotten away with it, he is seized with this uncontrollable urge to confess in public, which he does kind of raving in the middle of a public, marketplace type area, which of course lands him in chains and sentenced to hang for his crime. And that's where he is as he tells the story. But The story itself might not be all that remarkable as far as Poe's stories go, but it does bring up this interesting idea. It personifies this imp of the perverse, the idea of wanting to do something simply because it is something that should not be done, either like morally, you know, maybe it's a violation of norms, or because it's against one's own interest, that there's just some compelling force telling you not to do it. And that's the very reason you can't stop thinking about doing it.
Yeah, I mentioned the Telltale Heart earlier, and I think that's I think most would agree that's probably a better story that deals with a very similar premise. The idea, of course, in that, if you haven't read it, is that this guy killed an old man and buried him under the boards in what is living room, I believe. Mm-hmm. The police come to ask questions, and he just hears the thumping of the heart until it drives him bonkers, and he just starts pulling up the boards, right, and or telling the investigators, like, look, he's under there, pull up the boards, I killed him, and his heart is beating. And in that, he's dealing with the imp of the perverse as well,
yeah.
Manifested as this nagging, beating heart.
Now, it's been a while since I've read The Telltale Heart. Maybe you can answer this better than I. Do you think that – does guilt play a role in that story? Is he guilty about what he has done, and is a feeling of guilt driving him toward his confession? Or is it more like The Imp of the Perverse where he doesn't even seem to feel bad about it? He's just got this urge to tell.
Well, you know, it's been a while since I've read it, or I remember seeing like a stage adaptation of it as a kid. It's been a while since I've interacted with either, but I remember I used to think it was more of the guilt issue because that seems like the obvious trope, right? The idea that you've done this horrible thing, and the weight of the thing you've done eventually pulls out the confession. But having become acquainted with The Imp of the Perverse now, which I before researching this episode I was not familiar with, mm-hmm. I think it really makes me realize that Poe was probably thinking about other ideas here,
right?
And he was dealing with something a little more complicated in the human mind, as opposed to this more cliched imbalancing in the human heart.
So maybe his urge to confess was not a moral urge, but more just kind of the imp of the perverse. It was a neuroticism.
Yeah.
So one thing I think about, especially given all the references to phrenology in this Poe story, I guess, you know, before you had psychology, you had pseudoscience like phrenology. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about, you know, what's the kind of bridge between these two worlds, you know, getting to modern psychology. And that makes me go to Freudianism. I don't know if your brain kind of goes to the same place there.
Oh, yes.
But I mean, you see echoes of things like the imp of the perverse in the writings in the psychoanalysis style of Freud, right, where he talked about things like a death drive or a death instinct, right? And would that be sort of related?
Yeah, I believe so. And I've I found a few authors that have chimed in on this. Mm-hmm. So Sigmund Freud, just to refresh, lived 1856 through 1939, and he's best remembered for his work on the unconscious mind. But he also theorized about the role of powerful instincts that energize the mind. Mm-hmm. And these instincts are numerous and varied, but he grouped them into two main categories. There's Eros, the life instinct, and then there's Thanatos, the death instinct. And these names, of course, refer to the Greek mythological gods of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So the sexual influence of the libido only connects directly to the instincts of Eros, while the instincts of Thanatos focus on aggression, self-destruction, and cruelty. So I think it would be reasonable to situate the imp of the perverse within the Freudian instinct family of Thanatos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was looking around for papers on this, and I found a really good one from Lorelei Caraman. And she explored this in a 2014 paper titled "The Urge to Tell Versus the Need to Conceal: Confession as Narrative Desire in Poe's The Black Cat, The Telltale Heart, and The Imp of the Perverse."
Oh, okay.
And this was published in American and British Studies Annual. And as the title indicates, the author, Caraman, points out that Poe considered the drive to confess in not only the imp, but also in the more well-known black cat and the telltale heart. Quote, "What is noteworthy is the nature of these confessions, their inexplicable, irrational quality, as if driven by a certain kind of urgency, by a force seemingly independent of their will. If the crimes committed appear more or less calculated, their confessions, by contrast, are almost unaccountably impulsive."
That's totally accurate to the actual writing of the story, The Imp of the Perverse, I mean, the author is cold and calculating and psychopathic about the crime. You know, he thinks it through. He plans it out. He doesn't appear to feel bad about it. But then the desire to confess comes on as just this kind of like obsession from out of nowhere that he can't keep his mouth closed. He's running around thinking, I'm about to blurt it out. And then he does.
Yeah. In this paper, the author points out that past critics such as Arthur Brown and Henry Sussman have taken all of this apart, with the latter, Sussman, pointing out that the act of confession in these tales is a, quote, transgression of the boundaries between the private and the public. Kind of like, again, that gray line between thought and action, for instance. In these stories, we see something that exists in the mind leaking out. The desire to tell overpowers the desire for concealment.
One thing I wonder about with the references to phrenology in the story is that in the 19th century, there could easily have been anxieties about the idea of an emerging science of the mind. You ever think about this? Like that so a person always has their private thoughts. Their thoughts are their own, or maybe they're between them and the God they believe in or whatever, but they're private in some way. Other people can't know about them. But I wonder if you live in a world where there are all these burgeoning sciences and the sciences are increasingly intruding into domains like life and the social sciences and the mind itself and emerging fields like psychology, you have to start to wonder, will people be able to read my mind with these sciences? Is there going to be a diminution of the private privilege with one's own thoughts?
When we see this kind of anxiety reflected in so many works of science fiction over the years, the idea of thought police, determining what's going on inside your head, of passing through that boundary between action and thought. I was, in fact, just reading a Peter Watts short story about this very topic. But in these stories, something that Kahneman points out and drives home, and referencing the work of these other scholars, is that, it's not as simple as, oh, this character is mad, and that's why they did their crime and or blurted it out, but that there's something going on in the unconscious that is, by definition, unreadable. And that's the ultimate spooky, scary, mysterious part, that there's something going on in there, that there are these contradictory drives in the subconscious, and we don't really know what to expect from them.
Well, yeah, I can see this story situated again in kind of a bridge land between an old model that might often – like an old model of the mind that might have often said, if you have drives or desires that don't feel like yours, that's a demon, like that you could actually have the devil whispering in your ear that it's an imp, and you've got devil possession and all that. And then you've got this this new way of thinking about things where maybe you don't consciously understand all of your own drives and desires and motivations.
Yeah, absolutely. In all of this, I can't help but think back to, I can't remember the exact biblical passage, but the basic idea that you see reflected in a lot of Christian theology, that if you do something in your heart, it is as if you did it in real life, as if you actually committed the act.
Yeah.
And even that, without getting into kind of like, the theological discourse on it, that's kind of dealing in this thin line, or this at times seemingly thin line, between thought and action, between contemplation of the illogical and committing the illogical.
Yeah, and in that whole thing, I can see arguments on both sides of the whole, like if you are – whoever has felt wrath against his brother has committed murder in his heart. Mm-hmm. On one hand, that seems like that's kind of a very bad lesson to teach people, right?
Right.
That, like it's just as bad to think about doing something bad as it is to actually do it. It kind of blurs the line of like resistance to evil, right?
Right. Especially as we proceed through this episode, we're going to get into some areas where it really shows how problematic that is.
Yeah, exactly.
To say, don't think that, you know, try to think something else.
But, I mean, it does highlight, even if we can say that's maybe bad advice, it does highlight something. Mm-hmm. And what it highlights is that, you know, if you allow yourself to contemplate something that you know you should not do a lot, you may very well wear down your resistance to doing it.
Right. All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will chase the imp a little bit more through the subconscious. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. So we've been discussing this idea of the imp of the perverse that comes from this Edgar Allan Poe short story from the 1840s, where there is this strong impulse to do something just because you shouldn't do it and not for other reasons. So I was reading an article about this in Psychology Today by Emile Bruneau, who is a professor at UPenn, and it brought up a few interesting things. So this article tells an interesting story about the imp and inhibition and neuroscience. And the story starts when Bruneau was in graduate school, and he talks about how he witnessed a neuropathology examination of a deceased patient. And so a neuropathology examination involves cutting open the brain and examining it and figuring out, you know, was there any damaged tissues or neural degeneration. And also present at this examination was a social worker who had known the patient before he died. And so the autopsy revealed degeneration in the prefrontal cortex, especially of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And this is the outer part of the brain starting above the temples and sort of reaching up onto the outside of the forehead. And Bruneau mentions that this area is important for cognitive control. I was reading about its role in cognition and behavior, and it's generally believed to have a lot to do with many different kinds of executive function. This includes things like selective attention, choosing what to pay attention to and what to think about, things like working memory and meta-memory. So meta-memory is the cognitive management of memories, like judging whether a particular memory is relevant or correct. But this area also appears to have things to do with planning, with regulating and overriding emotions, and crucially with inhibition. And the management of inhibition also appears to be a major function of the prefrontal cortex in general, which, remember, showed damage all over in this patient. So because of this physical neuropathology, the doctor performing the autopsy asked the man's social worker if he had had any issues with impulsiveness and control. And the social worker said, yes, in fact, later in life, this man had repeatedly had a problem with jumping out of moving cars.
Oh, wow.
Jumping out of moving cars. And I thought that's really interesting because that's not just something like, you know, taking food out of somebody's hand or sexually inappropriate behavior, things that are certainly wrong, but that you can see how disinhibition would allow just sort of natural urges that people have otherwise to come out without being mediated by the thought, I shouldn't do that. With jumping out of moving cars, you have to wonder more, like, where does that urge come from to begin with? And in fact, this kind of thing is more common than we might normally imagine. Bruneau himself writes that, quote, 57% of people with frontotemporal dementia, which is neural degeneration that targets the frontal and temporal lobes, violate social norms, engaging in sexual transgressions and public nudity, shoplifting in front of store managers, eating out of the trash. It is common knowledge in the field of neuroscience now that these behaviors are due to a problem of disinhibition because of a deterioration of the cognitive control network of the lateral prefrontal cortex. And so I was looking into this more, and I found even more support for the role of the prefrontal cortex in inhibiting imp-like behaviors, and more evidence that when the prefrontal cortex is impaired, inhibition suffers, and we begin to act out transgressive and inappropriate behaviors. So one study I looked at was called Diagnosis and Management of Behavioral Issues in Frontotemporal Dementia by Manukeri and Huey in Current Neurology and Neuroscience Reports from 2012. And they write that behavioral disinhibition is a classic hallmark of the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia. Quote, within the first several years of symptoms, patients can behave contrary to social norms. They may inappropriately touch or aggressively approach strangers or even engage in theft or other criminal behaviors. Patients may also disregard subtler social norms to make offensive jokes or sexual remarks, encroach on the personal space of others, and exhibit childish behavior and a general lack of etiquette. Disinhibition may also be exhibited in the form of rash or impulsive actions like gambling or repeatedly falling for financial scams. The largest autopsy-confirmed study of BVFTD, or behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, found 76% of patients exhibited behavioral disinhibition or impulsivity. So it seems like when something happens to this part of the brain, when you've got impairment of the frontotemporal area, you see this almost all the time, that there is a problem with regulating one's behavior, and you see people acting out things that they might think about but wouldn't normally do.
And this is all quite an imp to consider, because again, we're getting back to the idea that the choice is kind of being taken out of our hands, right?
Yeah.
In this case, we're getting down to essentially brain injury.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing really always makes me consider stuff like criminal justice. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we say we want to live in a society where people are held accountable for their actions, and that seems to make sense to me intuitively. You don't want people to just go around wantonly harming other people and getting away with it, mm-hmm. and not facing any consequences. But then at the same time, it's hard to look at stuff like this and think that it really makes sense to punish people for their behaviors, mm-hmm. when our behavior, you know, we can go out and hurt people because we have a tumor in a certain part of our brain, or because we're experiencing dementia due to old age or some kind of brain disease, or because we have a head injury, all kinds of physical facts that we would agree people are not at all to blame for, contribute to them doing things that violate social norms and harm other people. And so if that's the case, also people didn't, I mean, pick the brain they were born with either. You didn't ask to be born with a brain that makes you more likely to be aggressive or invade people's personal space. And yet then again, we can't like encourage those behaviors. I don't know. This kind of thing leaves you in a real pickle when thinking about how to deal with human misbehavior.
Yeah. I do feel like a lot of it does kind of spring forth from older ideas about, you know, in which, you know, committing a, you know, an improper act is a statement on a pure moral failing.
Yeah.
Problem in the soul, as opposed to something that is, you know, that is a medical issue.
But I was also further wondering about the idea of like impulses and impulse control, because, okay, so we know that certain parts of the brain are very important for keeping the imp of the perverse from taking control of the wheel, right? From the prefrontal cortex, the frontotemporal regions, these play some kind of major role in inhibition. And if there's injury to them or something is wrong in there, you can suddenly start doing things that you normally would stop yourself before acting out. But I wonder about the first half of the equation, like the urges themselves. Where do the urges to do the wrong thing come from in the first place? In this article I was talking about a minute ago, Bruneau identifies the orbitofrontal cortex as a likely seat of impulses like this, and he links this to the way that like tumors in the orbitofrontal cortex can sometimes cause people to suddenly start engaging in criminal behaviors that they never would have before, and like the awful history of frontal lobotomy, you know, that went into the orbitofrontal cortex and severed connections in there through the eye socket. And the idea that this would reduce aggression and inappropriate behaviors, which it often did, but also just did general damage to people's brains and personalities in many cases. And that's a kind of horrible story in the history of medical neuroscience.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the real life horror stories kind of circling around all of this.
Yeah. But anyway, I looked this up, and based on all the literature I was reading, it also seems like the orbitofrontal cortex plays some major role in decision making, in emotions, in behavioral inhibition, such that injuries or tumors or degenerative disease in the OFC can lead to disinhibited behavior, though I'm no neuroscientist, obviously, but reading around, I can't see quite exactly the reason that the imp would necessarily be there, except to say that like the lateral prefrontal cortex, the orbitofrontal cortex is generally important for value-based decision-making and behavioral control. For example, I was looking at a 2017 paper in Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience by Corponet et al. That just found a strange thing that it increases in the volume of the prefrontal cortex and intraprefrontal functional connectivity were related to impulsive and antisocial psychopathic traits. But anyway, so multiple regions of the prefrontal cortex do appear to play a significant role in the generation of impulses to act out and in the control and inhibition of those impulses when we judge them inappropriate. You want to do something bad, but you stop yourself from doing that bad thing. A lot of what's going on there seems to depend on and happen in the prefrontal cortex. But I guess in any of these cases, you do have to ask the question, is this the imp of the perverse, or is this just a desire for something that you would normally be able to inhibit with your behavioral control, with your executive function? Or is it really the perversity that motivates the action in the first place? Like there are all kinds of things we could do in order to get something that is an otherwise normal intrinsic desire. People with disinhibition patterns violate norms and act inappropriately to get food, to get sexual gratification, to get revenge, or to get items they want, to express power over people. And there are good reasons for not doing all these things based on our morals, but the underlying motivations to do them exist independently. So I wonder what provides the impulse to act perversely in the true spirit of the Poe story. Are there cases where we can only understand why the brain would act contrary to its awareness of norms for the reason that that action is contrary to norms with no identifiable other motivation? Cases where the perversity is clearly what causes the action in the first place.
Fortunately, we have a very interesting theory to discuss about where a lot of this is coming from.
Yeah.
So we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss the ironic process of mental control.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world.
Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So, Robert, we're asking the question, have we ever been able to identify any cases where there is something like the imp of the perverse, where the perversity of a thought or impulse or action actually does tend to cause the brain to favor it? And one place we can take this line of thought is to the Harvard psychology professor Daniel M. Wegner, who passed away in 2013, but who wrote about this idea of the ironic process of mental control.
That's right. And he actually begins the paper with a passage from Poe, from The Imp of the Perverse. But the first paragraph of this paper is just pretty spot on, I think, in terms of like sort of you know, striking a chord with something that we can all relate to. Quote, "It sometimes seems that our desires to control our minds are met by an inordinate measure of failure. Whether we want to stop a worry, concentrate on a task, go to sleep, escape a bad mood, distract ourselves from pain, be humble, relax, avoid prejudice, or serve yet other mental goals, we find ourselves faltering again and again. Indeed, our attempts at mental control fall short so often that we may stop to wonder, along with Poe, whether there is some part of our minds, an imp of the perverse, that ironically strives to compel our errors. The theory of ironic processes of mental control make precisely this claim." And so in his ironic process theory, which he presents in this paper, he argues that, quote, "the ironies of mental life are not just happenstance examples of the frailty of human endeavors, but rather are logically entailed by the nature of mental control."
So he's arguing that the very nature of the way cognition happens tends to favor us thinking about things that we're trying not to think about.
Exactly. Yeah, he's saying that you know, when we attempt to exert mental control via what he refers to as the operating process, to fill the mind with a desired array of emotions or thoughts, you know, like I'm going to cheer up, or I'm going to get into a calm state of mind, whatever the desire is.
Stop worrying.
Yeah, I'm going to stop worrying. When we do that, the monitoring process kicks in to ask, is this the case? Is this working? Is this how I'm actually feeling? So it not only searches for failure, but, quote, tends to create the failure.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what he's saying. It's not just that we're not very good at controlling the contents of our brains. Often the attempt to control the contents of our – not just our brains, our minds. The attempt to control the contents of our minds backfires spectacularly.
Yeah. It's like we're saying, I would rather not be sad right now. I'm going to go ahead and load happiness. And then the monitoring process says, let me check. Nope, you're sad. We're going to schedule down for another hour of sad. So this is a wonderful paper. The title is Ironic Processes of Mental Control by Daniel M. Wegner, W-E-G-N-E-R, published in the Psychological Review in 1994. And if you search around, you can find this one online pretty easily. But he presents some other individuals' work to support this idea. One of them is the work of French chemist Michel Chevreul, and he is known for Chevreul's pendulum. So he debunked a spiritualist illusion in 1833 in which a weighted body suspended by a string from the fingers was found to oscillate back and forth when concentrated upon.
Uh-huh.
Similar, this is pretty... This
How
is
can the, you explain that?
Well, it's the same... the best way to explain it, because I think most of us have probably not manipulated this pendulum, but if you've ever played with a Ouija board, well, then you have experienced the same thing.
Right.
It is a kinesthetic illusion. The idea that the causation of movement is occurring without the perception of our own conscious muscle movement, also known as the ideometer phenomenon. And it's connected to automatic writing, to dowsing, and other alleged supernatural acts. Anything that involves you not moving something, feeling like you're not moving something, but actually moving something.
Yeah. Though it also reminds me of the psychomotor problem known as target fixation, which I'd read about years ago but just recently came to my mind. So this is something that occurs in driving and piloting. I've read about it primarily with respect to operating a motorcycle for some reason. I don't know why a motorcycle specifically and not other vehicles. But here's the basic idea, Robert. You're steering a vehicle and you suddenly notice an obstacle or threat that you need to avoid. And then you steer directly into the obstacle. Mm-hmm. An example I've read about is that, say, you're on a motorcycle in a motorcycle race on a closed track, and then one cycle veers off the track and crashes. It's apparently, in this case, not unusual for cycles going along behind it to steer off and follow the crashed motorcycle. And this is usually described as a panic reflex, like you see an obstacle or a crash or something threatening or dangerous, and you immediately, because it's threatening and dangerous, focus all your attention on that thing so as not to run into it. But because you focus all your attention on that thing, you unconsciously steer your vehicle directly toward it.
Oh.
I am curious why this is mainly talked about with motorcycles and not so much with other motor vehicles. It could just be that the motorcycles and motorcyclists who talk about this are often operating at a faster speed. I don't know.
It does seem to line up with a number of the principles we're talking about here,
right?
In Wegener's theory. And now Wegener also brings up Freud's counterwill, to bring it back to Sigmund Freud. Freud's read on what's happening here is that we can't do the thing we want to do sometimes, as if there's another will within us countering the will to do the thing. And he employed this in his consideration of hysteria. He also brought up the law of reversed effort by Charles Baudouin from 1921. And this was kind of an early hit on the same ideas of, involved in the ironic process theory.
Mm-hmm.
But in the ironic process theory paper, Wegener lays out a model of how this goes down. First with the effortful operating process and then the effortless monitoring process. And that's part of the maddening thing about it, right? It's like you can exert so much will to try and change your mind state. But then the resistance is just, it's like it's an alien force that has its own reserves of energy to draw on, limitless even. And then he goes on to consider the evidence from experiments into movement, prejudice, self-presentation, belief, disbelief, sleep, wakefulness, pain. It's really a robust paper in this mm-hmm. regard.
And he did a bunch of empirical research in this
yes.
area. I mean, doing experiments to show directly, and in fact, in some ways, it's not hard to demonstrate. For example, by asking people to verbalize a stream of consciousness, you can find quite easily that people who are told to try hard not to think about something end up thinking about it a lot.
And in this section on chronic production of ironic effects, he discusses how all of this can potentially lead to a positive feedback loop of ironic effects, wearing you down with increased mental load as everything, quote, is magnified toward psychopathological extremes.
Hmm.
Which, you know, even though, he's talking about something, he's talking about this in the sense that, this is how our minds seem to work. But on the other hand, this sounds just completely awful. This sounds like a terrible system, right?
Yeah.
Where you just keep running up against, a potential positive feedback loop of increasingly worrisome effects like this. It reminds me a lot of what is referred to in psychology as catastrophic thinking, mm-hmm. Where you end up obsessing over extreme and or irrational worst case scenarios.
Yeah, catastrophizing. Yeah. This is a tendency to always look out for in your loved ones or when you catch yourself doing it. Because, I mean, it can be a sign that something's really wrong with your thought patterns when you're always trying to imagine what's the worst way things could possibly go.
Yeah. It brings me back again to something we've discussed in the show before. We've talked about chronesthesia, mental time travel,
mm-hmm.
or, as well as theory of mind, and how both of these play in our ability to sort of run simulations of how the future might go.
Yeah.
And so when we're going into that meeting with our boss, we have various simulated ideas of how things will go. probably some that are very reasonable, but then you're going to have some that are extreme. Maybe you're overly optimistic, and there's one that's just a fantasy where you get, like, you know, the billion-dollar raise or something. Uh-huh. And then there are the ones that are more catastrophic in nature, ones that are maybe getting into the territory of the imp of the perverse. What if I lick the table or eat a pen, that sort of thing. But then aren't we not, like, wasting our efforts on these models when we should be using our mental energy toward the models that are more possible?
I mean, on one hand, yeah, it does seem like there is adaptive value in being able to simulate future events. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like we waste a lot of this potential we have, this ability we have to simulate future events in our minds on, yeah, just ruining ourselves and ruining our emotional state by obsessing with things that are not helpful.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can be hard to understand exactly why that happens.
But anyway, back to Wegner here. He ultimately argues that the ironic process theory could explain a lot about our mental control. But he also brings it back to the imp, saying, quote, "The theory also accounts for one further class of effects, the class that cries out for explanation and from which we often cry out for relief. The theory suggests that the ironic monitor is responsible for the instances in which we find that we do, say, think, or feel precisely what we least intend."
Yeah, I mean, I think when you consider, like, the model we were talking about earlier, that clearly within the brain there are there are subsystems for generating impulses to action, and then there are other systems that provide inhibitory control. You know, executive function of the brain says to some impulses, no, let's not do that. Mm-hmm. But when there is, say, a thought that you are repeatedly returning to, especially because you're trying to avoid thinking it due to the ironic process of mental control, you keep thinking, am I not thinking about it? And every time you think that, you think it. That's bringing it constantly to mind. And then if there's ever a failure of inhibition for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you know, either just a kind of like momentary glitch or because you've got a neurodegenerative disease or a tumor or whatever, that impulse generated by the ironic process, by checking on your own mind to make sure you're not thinking about the thing you're not supposed to think about, turns into an action.
Now, all of this sounds overwhelming, really.
Yeah.
I guess the imp wins. Like, you know, what can one do against this kind of situation? How can we possibly it's depressing to think that we have such a difficulty in changing our mind state, even though we obviously put a lot of energy into trying to do so. Mm-hmm. So it might lead some of you to wonder, well, okay, well, what did Wegner have to say about this? Did he have any advice for dealing with these forces?
Yeah. And so Wegner actually gave a presentation about the imp of the perverse and about thought suppression to the American Psychological Association in 2011, where he reviewed his research over his career on this subject. And there was an article discussing this presentation in the APA Journal by Leah Wienerman. And it discusses how Wegner said in his presentation that it's clear from the research that attempting not to think about something not only doesn't work, it makes you more likely to think about that thing. But what people always want to know is what you're just asking about, Robert. Okay, if the imp is there and simply attempting not to think about something will make you think about it more and maybe even make you more likely to do it possibly, is there anything you can do to defeat the imp? There does not, unfortunately, appear to be a foolproof method, but Wegner laid out several methods that he and his colleagues had discovered which had some degrees of success and empirical support. Number one is, instead of trying not to think about the thing you don't want to think about something else. Busy your mind with other contents. Wegner and colleagues found in at least one other study that when they asked people to think about a red Volkswagen instead of a white bear, the people were somewhat more successful than when they were just told not to think of a white bear. Trying not to think about something is a losing game, but if you positively think about something else instead, then you have a better chance. And I'd say this is one case where the empirical research does seem to line up with I don't know, at least what seems to be reasonable conventional wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just obsess about not wanting to feel what you're feeling. You should find something to do, right? When you find something to do, when you find another project, then your mind becomes sort of full of other things rather than just like a void or a vacuum that you're trying to keep the bad stuff out of. Next thing he recommends is mentally postpone unwanted thoughts. I thought this was kind of interesting. Apparently, some research has found that if you just give people a designated period of 30 minutes to worry about something, they worry less about it at other times. So if the imp of the perverse is continually turning your mind to an unwanted subject, Wegner suggests telling yourself, I'm going to think about that sometime next Wednesday, and I won't think about it until then. And somehow this is actually, or at least apparently, this is somewhat effective. Another strategy he recommends is lighten your mental load or avoid multitasking. Quote, one study found that people under increased mental load show an increase in the availability of thoughts of death, one of the great unwanted thoughts for most people. Though, I mean, I kind of wonder about this one. I mean, this could be – seems like it could be resulted to stress and a lot of different things. Next one apparently is exposure therapy. You think about the unwanted thought deliberately in controlled ways, in controlled settings, and it may become less intrusive at other times. And this strikes me as perhaps one of the benefits that benefits of something like traditional talk therapy. It provides a positive and controlled setting to pay attention to unpleasant and unwanted thoughts so that they become less persistent and intrusive at other times. And then finally, the last one is he recommends mindfulness meditation, learning how to manage your attention and consciousness through mindfulness meditation practice. This does appear somewhat helpful. And this makes sense to me. If you've never tried mindfulness meditation, it's worth – I think everybody should try to give it at least one shot and see what you think about it. There are many different kinds of meditation practice. Mindfulness specifically is about – attention and experience. It's usually done by having an object of focus. Your own breath is a common one. And you just try to pay intense, unbroken attention to a thing. Now, of course, you will, you know, your mind will wander. And then you just sort of continually notice your own mental experiences and return your attention to the object of focus. It tends to make you calmer and better at understanding the way your own attention works.
Yeah, and of course we've discussed meditation on the show before. So if anyone wants a deeper dive into that, certainly look back in the archives for this show.
Mm-hmm.
But this gives us a little bit of hope. It does provide. Hopefully, we can close out this episode with some hope for all of us dealing with our own personal imps.
Totally, and I especially feel for me, I think for a lot of people these days, there are internet imps. The internet imps come in at us all the time. I feel like our brains are especially vulnerable these mm-hmm. days because of social media and online headlines and all that. Our electronic connectedness has made us all the more vulnerable to impish behavior from the information world.
Now, in this episode, we talked about intrusive thoughts a good bit. We talked about, you know, the call of the void, et cetera. So I think it is good to close out by just reminding everybody that if you're dealing with intrusive thoughts of say, suicide, a sympathetic ear is only a phone call away. In the United States, consider calling the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255 and visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org for additional resources tailored toward general and specific needs, such as those of youth, disaster survivors, Native Americans, veterans, loss survivors, LGBTQ, and attempt survivors. You'll find a list of international suicide hotlines at suicide.org. But to close things out on a lighter note, Joe, the imp of the perverse, did you imagine it looking like a ghoulie, a gremlin, a hobgoblin, or some other cinematic diminutive monster?
Oh, the imp of the perverse is Jabba the Hutt's little buddy. What's he called?
Oh, yes. Oh, goodness. I'm blanking on his name. Something like...
The little beak dog.
Yes, yes. Something like Scarless Fudge, but not Scarless Fudge.
Why? What did you picture, Robert?
I pictured a hobgoblin from the movie Hobgoblins, for sure.
That's a very, very good choice.
But a gremlin or a ghoulie would also be acceptable.
I know you're partial to ghoulies.
Yeah, I mean, ghoulies are pretty terrifying. That's probably what came to my mind when I first imagined the imp of the perverse. All right, so we're going to close it out. If you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes. And also be sure to check out our other show, Invention. It's an invention-by-invention exploration of human techno-history.
Are you not subscribed to Invention yet? If not, get on that. Go right over. It's called Invention. You can get it anywhere you get podcasts. Go and subscribe now. If you like this show, we think you'll love that one. So anyway, huge thanks to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.